There's COVID-19, and then there's another epidemic in America.
We are struggling with an epidemic of insecurity, which is a function of the recognition that things are constantly being taken away because the crumbling of a set of systems that undergird the basic means of a dignified life in our country and across our lives.
That's Abdu Al-Sayed, former Michigan gubernatorial candidate and health director of Detroit's Public Health Department. We talk with him about his new book, Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. Then, a debut novel explores the power dynamics inside a county jail. We talk with David Maloney about his book, Barker House. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Americans everywhere are in the streets protesting police violence against black people, saying loud and clear that black lives matter. But while the killing of George Floyd was a spark, or maybe the last straw, I can't help but think that the protests are about much more. The violence of health disparities against people of color the COVID pandemic has revealed, the violence of poorly funded schools, the violence of poisoned neighborhoods, and the list goes on. All these kinds of social violence hit black and brown communities the hardest, but they've been devastating poor and working class white Americans as well. And that may be why many whites are beginning to understand that they too have a stake in fighting systemic racism. They too have a stake in overcoming the divide and conquer strategy of the ruling class, a strategy that perpetuates what my guest Abdu Al-Sayed calls an epidemic of insecurity. An epidemiologist, Al-Sayed decided to run for governor of Michigan in 2018 because he saw so clearly how our political and economic system is rigged against the communities he'd been tasked to protect as director of Detroit's Public Health Department. He lost that fight, but won a very respectable 400,000 votes, despite being a first-time candidate with a politically difficult name. Al-Sayed's new book, Healing Politics, combines memoir, science, and public policy to diagnose the challenges facing America and lay out a way forward. It's a terrific read, and during a time of pandemic and social upheaval, it's a crucial text for those who want to see a better America for all. Abdu Al-Sayed, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be with you today, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
This book, Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. Well, what an appropriate title. What an appropriate topic, actually. But the epidemic is not the COVID epidemic. It's an epidemic of insecurity. You diagnose that, you characterize it, and you prescribe for it. Tell us what you mean by an epidemic of insecurity.
Yeah, Francesca, I had the privilege of touring the state of Michigan as a candidate for governor in 2017 and 2018. And I trained as an epidemiologist, and you know, I think everybody knows what an epidemiologist does now, but our job is to understand the distribution and determinants of disease in populations. And I thought the small epidemiologist inside my mind was going to have to take a seat for a couple of years as I put on a politician hat. And I realized that as I was traveling the state, I had a central question that I needed to identify to be an effective politician, which is what ails us and why? And then I found that epidemiologist in my mind on those long car rides home constantly debating what I thought it was. And this book is a reflection of the answer that me and the epidemiologist in my mind came to, which is that we are struggling with an epidemic of insecurity, which is a function of the recognition that things are constantly being taken away because the crumbling of a set of systems that undergird the basic means of a dignified life in in our country and across our lives, whether that's a healthcare system that leaves 10% of people without healthcare and leaves another 50% of them behind a paywall functionally for most of the year, whether that's an economic system that is chewing up high-quality jobs and spitting out gigs, whether that is a housing system that leaves us subsidizing people who earn six figures a year more than it does people who struggle to earn five, or a political system, probably first and foremost, that has been co-opted by all of those other systems. And so, you know, in this book, I try and diagnose both the subjective reality of feeling that insecurity and how it manifests, and then the objective causes, what I call a miasma of that insecurity.
So you didn't start out as an epidemiologist. You started out by going to medical school, and you practiced as a resident for a while. In fact, you planned to be an internist, a practicing doctor, but a patient named Martha stopped you in your tracks. Tell us what happened.
That's right. So I actually, it was in my last year of medical school, and so I had applied to residency, but I didn't actually end up completing my application. It had been finished, and then I pulled it. I had this patient at a hospital in where I was training, and she had fallen and hit her head on a cold, icy day in January. And, you know, I was the sub-intern on the floor, and so my job was to work directly with the attending physician to try and coordinate care. And one of my jobs was to liaise with the emergency room on behalf of the rest of the hospital or the hospital floor where we were caring for patients. And when I came down, I asked, you know, what seemed to be the obvious question, which is, what did the CT show? And, you know, if you fall and you hit your head and you have any means at all, you're going to get a CT examination simply because, you know, we want to rule out any sort of brain bleed. She didn't get one. And the resident with whom I was talking basically said, look, she'd be a social admit, which is doctor speak for saying that this is a woman who's indigent, who came in because she was inebriated in the morning. And we want to get her back out on the street where she can get to some alcohol before she starts withdrawing, stop throwing up roadblocks. And I got really frustrated with that because, you know, she didn't get the standard of care. And you could see that she wasn't altogether all that healthy beyond the fact that she'd hit her head. I ended up having her admitted and took care of her for 2 weeks. You know, she ended up having full-blown AIDS, which they hadn't picked up in the emergency room. She had uncontrolled diabetes. Her HIV had infested her adrenal glands, which control blood pressure. And so, you know, she had this low blood pressure problem. She had an actively bleeding pelvic mass, none of which really got picked up. And so I worked really hard for her because she became sort of a referendum for me on whether or not I was going to pursue a clinical career. And ultimately, we found her a discharge where we would send her to the only rehab facility that accepted HIV-positive patients and then get her coordinated into the housing that she had access to because of her situation. And on the day of discharge, she decided not to do all that, and she decided that she was going to go home with her daughter. And you know, I thought a lot about that case because I knew that that was not going to be a great decision for her. She hadn't talked to her daughter for years because of her drinking. And a couple weeks later, I happened to be going to have dinner with a friend at a Turkish restaurant, get on the subway train, and I see a woman laid out on the subway seats, and she turns her face, and it's Martha. And that night, I went and I pulled my residency application. And it really was because I realized that a lot of the challenges that I wanted to take on were systematic, had a lot more to do with what you have to do outside of a healthcare setting to be able to empower people rather than what happens when they walk into your stumble into your clinic or hospital. And that really was what turned my career.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word systematic. In fact, you take a systems approach to epidemiology. You call it social epidemiology. I'm sure many people call it that, but it is different than, let's say, classical epidemiology. Tell us, what is the difference between social epidemiology and the other kind?
Yeah. Systems epidemiology is about recognizing that the traditional approach to science, where by definition we have controlled and uncontrolled variables, where you control all but one controlled variable and ask what happens under different circumstances to the uncontrolled variable, may miss the fact that all of those variables are interacting with each other all the time. And it may be that those interactions are potentially more important than the variables themselves. And system science, of which systems epidemiology is a part, is about asking, well, how important are those interactions? And could we be missing them based on the traditional approach to doing science? And so in systems epidemiology, you're really concentrating on the ways that interactions between different features of the world may be shaping the experience of health and disease for populations. And I wrote my dissertation about complex systems and epidemiology and how it could help us to understand something like disparities in obesity. And I was in the UK for my PhD, and so that's where I focused. But it really does force us to ask, well, what happens when the sum is greater than the individual parts themselves? And what does that tell us about the way we ought to intervene in the world? And so much of the approach that I take to public health and politics is driven by that systems approach.
Give us an example. I mean, maybe from when you were the director of the Detroit Health Department, it had been privatized in 2012. Then you got hired. You made it public again. Do you have an example from something that you encountered there where you used the systems approach or the social epidemiology approach?
Yeah, let me actually just speak to the confluence between that moment and now to be very systems about it. I wanted to do something about the fact that in Detroit, our people face threefold the probability of asthma hospitalization as the rest of the state. And when you ask why, a lot of that has to do with the nature of the air that people are forced to breathe because, of course, Detroit is a highly industrial town. And because of the power of industry in Detroit, the ability to get away with very lax enforcement on that pollution is a real problem. And one project that we took on was to stand up to the Marathon Petroleum Refinery that sits on the southwest side of Detroit, one of the most polluted zip codes in the entire state, that also has some of the highest prevalence of lung disease in the state. And, you know, of course, those two things are obvious to be related. But now we're in the middle of a COVID-19 pandemic. And one of the questions that people seem to throw their hands up and ask all the time is, why is it that this is so much more dangerous among black folks than white folks, right? 2.5-fold the number of deaths to black Michiganders as the average, 40% of all deaths versus 14% of the population. And the answer there goes back to comorbidities. Well, we know that asthma kills you because it takes your breath away. That's also how COVID-19 kills you. Now, you have both of those things hitting you at once. Of course, it's going to be more deadly for you because your baseline has been assaulted for years by the smokestacks that are down the street. And so, you know, you look at COVID-19, and if you were to just think about COVID-19 on its own, you would be missing the fact that COVID-19 is hitting a community that's already been pummeled for a long time by a system of racial patterning around who is most exposed to industrial waste and in what communities. And so these two things have to be seen together and cannot be seen separately. And then to complicate that even more, right, you think about an outcome like infant mortality. Could not be more different than asthma, could not be more different than COVID-19 death, right, in terms of the physiology, what happens underneath the skin. But when you look at the social physiology and social pathology, it's clear that these features are critical to shaping access to basic resources that can be used by people or not to protect them from infant mortality or asthma or COVID-19. And so there's this confluence of how they're shaped together that occurs well before we start looking at the pathology and the physiology that animates them that has to be understood and intervened upon at the same time. And then you ask all of these questions about, well, why? Do some communities have more political power than others? Why do some communities have to go out and earn their wage in the service and or substance economy rather than the information economy that you and I are engaged in right now? Why do some communities have to struggle with getting basic healthy foods to eat when others of us can go to one of five grocery stores within a mile of our homes? All of these things are patterns of the way that the economy and our politics and our social geography and racism all interact with each other. And so, you know, without understanding the web, it's really hard to understand any of the nodes.
Yeah, and it goes beyond asthma because, as you say, poor food leads to diabetes. Stress is inflammatory, and these are also closely related to the impact of COVID-19 on people.
That's right.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dr. Abdul El Sayed about his book, Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of our political epidemic. Then you moved from being an epidemiologist and you decided to go into politics. You ran for governor of Michigan in 2018. Why did you leave epidemiology and go into politics?
Yeah, you know, I'll give a simple answer and then a more complex answer. Rudolf Virchow is sort of a historical figure at the edges of medicine, public health, and politics, who I look up to a lot. And he has a quote, and I'm not going to directly quote it, but he says that medicine is a social science, and politics is nothing but medicine on a large scale. And that's what I was starting to appreciate, is that I really loved the work that I was doing at the health department, really appreciated the opportunity to see a problem and be able to really bring an institutional solve to that problem, and was really grateful for that opportunity. But at the same time, couldn't help but butt heads with the city leadership that didn't want to do things on very obvious public health issues like the lead epidemic in our community. And, you know, there are zip codes in Detroit where the prevalence of lead poisoning is fourfold the average of Flint at the height of the Flint water crisis, and did not want to talk about it because, of course, in the era of Flint, which that was, it was impolitic to talk about lead. I was worried about the city's water shutoffs, which have only stopped in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, because obviously shutting off water on people is bad. But, you know, the question I would always get is, like, how do we know that this is bad for people? And my question was, A, that's a bad question. You should be asking, how do we know that it's not bad for people? And then B, there is no public health without water, right? There is no health without water. This should be obvious. There are some questions we just don't ask because the answers are so stupidly obvious. So, you know, if you jump out of a plane without a parachute, that's a bad thing to do for obvious reasons. We don't ask if there has been a study that showed whether or not jumping out of planes without parachutes was associated with higher degree of mortality or morbidity, because the answer should be obvious. And, you know, I watched how the politics here obfuscated the obvious things we needed to do. Meanwhile, I was watching the Flint water crisis happen just 50 miles north of me. And then I watched Donald Trump get elected president. And at some point, there was an overall recognition that no matter what the level of government was, that government was not working for the people that I was trying to serve in a community like Detroit. And at that point, you know, there's a sort of "aw, what the hell" kind of moment. Some decisions in your life are too complex to try and calculate out. And that's where I think, you know, God gave us intuition. And so there was a just sense of, you know, this feels like the right thing to do right now. And I knew that, you know, my experience as a Egyptian-American son of immigrants raised by my father and my stepmother, who's a daughter of the American Revolution, could speak to a sense of who we were at our core. And then my work as a health commissioner in America's poorest city, I thought could have a lot of impact on solving the problems that my state was facing. And so for those reasons, and in many others, just a recognition of a frustration with the way that our politics were working at the time, I decided to run.
And, you know, you earned a whole lot of votes, over 400,000 votes. You did lose, but it was still a huge showing for somebody who had never run for office before and someone whose name starts with Abdul, as you point out in the book. You know, the title of this book is Healing Politics, and you actually have a chapter on politics, not just on the story of yourself in it, where you talk about all the barriers to democracy, money in politics, barriers to voting, voter suppression. I was struck by your discussion of gerrymandering. And you said that Michigan, which is a classic purple swing state, is one of the most gerrymandered in the country. In fact, there are way more Michiganders who are Democrats than Republicans, but the state has been in Republican hands for a long time. Describe how your campaign confronted the barriers to political representation.
Yeah, the ways in which power is concentrated. I don't think people quite appreciate, you know, the games that are played about it. You know, I ran in a three-way primary, and both of my opponents, I think, demonstrate the problems with the way that money gets deployed to concentrate political power in different ways. One of my opponents was a Republican before he decided to run as a progressive Democrat, but he had tens of millions of dollars to spend, ended up spending $10.5 million. And he ran, in effect, on my message. But if he's able to get my message to people first, then to them, it's his message. And that's really devastating. It shouldn't be that way. You know, people should have to hear people actually argue out what they believe and why they believe it. And, you know, if you look at straw polls coming out of our debates, it was clear that, you know, my telling of my message was a lot more convincing than his. And the other was someone who was a part of Michigan's political establishment for a long time. And, you know, the way that they moved money was that they had corporations give directly to an apparatus set up within the Democratic Party so that it didn't have to tell who its donors are, which is itself a problem. And then that apparatus would give money to a 527, which is a form of super PAC. And then that super PAC would run ads, and technically it's illegal for them to coordinate, but they would run ads featuring the candidate as a candidate. And so all of this allowed corporate money to flow into our primary, but not be traceable. And it was only traceable after the fact because these corporations had to say where they gave their money. And so you were able to trace the whole thing afterwards. And, you know, both of these means of moving money in politics they're devastating to the way that political decision-making is made, because most of the time it's a question of who knows who for what. And it's really hard to get known to run a campaign unless you have the money to be buying advertising. And because of the really snaky ways that money is allowed now to move into our politics, a lot of decisions are attempted to be bought, and opinion is attempted to be swayed. Now, you know, obviously all of us sort of see ourselves as being the masters of our own opinion, but I think sometimes we don't appreciate how effective advertisement can be in swaying that opinion, and that opens the door for money to then buy our opinion, and that's a really problematic thing.
Mm. Yeah, and that must have been Gretchen Whitmer, right?
That was.
Yes. Well, maybe there for the grace of God go I. You know, she's certainly under tremendous opposition that just typifies everything that is wrong with what you call about the politics of insecurity that we have so much, politics of resentment, hatred, exclusion that is being, you know, dumped on her as she tries to really protect people basically from this terrible pandemic and is being squeezed. You contrast the identity politics of insecurity versus the identity politics of empathy. So what is the politics of empathy? What's the difference between the two? And why is it so important?
Yeah, a lot is made about identity politics right now. And, you know, you look at empathy, which is this big point that I talk about in the book, about the need to be able to understand why people are doing what they're doing as they suffer this epidemic of insecurity, how it affects their behavior, and how we can change it. And I believe that rather than allowing ourselves to fall into this us versus them dynamic that has corrupted so much of our politics, that we have to take the time to ask, why do you feel the way you feel, and how is that animating what you do? And the thing about identities, right, is that, you know, if you think about what is empathy at a government scale, I mean, we technically call our congresspeople representative, like they represent us. And if you don't have people who represent you in the halls of power, then there's no way government can have any empathy. So I don't agree with folks who say, you know, we got to get identity out of it. There's just differences in how we live life and what we have to be paying attention to, which I talk a lot about in the book, based on who we are and where we, you know, come from in the world. And I don't mean that in terms of geographic space. I mean that in terms of experiential space. But there is also a identity politics that we cannot ignore, which is the identity politics of white supremacy. And it's the initial identity politics in American society. It's the identity politics that frames, you know, the extermination of Native Americans. It's the identity politics that frames slavery. And it's the identity politics that frames Jim Crow. It's the identity politics that frames America First. That is that identity politics of insecurity that tells us that if they take, there's less for me, that all of this is zero sum. Rather than the identity politics that I'm calling for, which is rather than buying into the same tools as that identity politics of insecurity. I believe that the identity politics of empathy ought to be about inclusion and ought to be about creating space for everyone. And it ought to reject us versus them dynamics, and it ought to embrace empathy, a willingness to dig deep and ask, who are you and what are you experiencing and how does that shape how you come to this world and what you do here? And I think if we're able to do that, it would change our politics tremendously. Now, at the same time, I get that a lot of people are frustrated, right? If you've been locked out of a political system for whatever means, you have a right to be angry and you have a right to be frustrated. I just don't know that it's effective. And so to me, right, as I think about how do we heal and how do we build, I'm looking for effective answers. And I believe that if we're able to reach across, look at someone in the eye and ask, why are you hurting and what can I do to help you? Even if the thing they think they want is not the right thing, that willingness to just step in and have heard somebody, I just think is so extremely powerful.
Yeah, and empathy politics leads to empathy policy. Lay out for us, what are some of the key components of empathy policy that can bring diverse groups together?
Yeah, I appreciate that question because I think once we recognize the way that insecurity hijacks our conversation about what we as a collective can do, we then start asking really big ideas that meet this moment. And never have we had a moment in our politics, frankly, since the Great Depression, even maybe beyond that, that we've needed to embrace big ideas. Some of the ones that I call for in the book, I write about 13 of them, and there are many others. But one of them is just to embrace the need to take on climate change and to recognize that in the work of doing that, we can provide millions of people high-quality union jobs that empower them and their families. And that's what the Green New Deal is. And the second, as folks, you know, if folks have ever heard me talk, it's probably about Medicare for All. I've got another book coming out about that in February. But I believe that we need a national health insurance program that has to eliminate out-of-pocket costs, that has to cover everything, and that has to take on the power of healthcare corporations that have, you know, left us in this position where we don't have the healthcare we need when we need it. If we need it, it's going to cost us so much that it might cripple us financially. And it leaves our healthcare institutions fickle and fragile to the kinds of attacks that we saw through COVID-19. And then a last one that I'll talk about is the responsibility I think we have to rebuild our mental health infrastructure. And I think this is something that doesn't get paid as much attention to, though it ought to in the context of COVID-19, that the next epidemic that's gonna follow after this one, that's already happening, but we're just not talking about it, is the epidemic of the mental health consequences of this. And our mental health infrastructure is so woefully inadequate to the degree of burden that we had even before COVID-19 fundamentally upended so many of our lives. And so we've got to really be building there.
Yes. Well, Dr., and I will say Dr., Abdul El Sayed, your book is Healing Politics, A Doctor's Journey into the Heart of Our Political Epidemic. It is a terrific book. It's beautifully written. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's my privilege. Thank you for reading the book, and thank you for giving me the space to talk about it with you. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Abdul El Sayed. Go to writersvoice.net to read some recent articles by him, as well as an excerpt from Healing Politics. Next up, a former corrections officer writes a novel based on his experiences. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. David Maloney was an aspiring teacher when the Great Recession hit. In his early 20s at the time, the only secure job he could find was as a corrections officer in a county jail in New Hampshire. After 4 years, he'd had it. The ugly power dynamics between guards and inmates, the stress, and the way jail culture promotes dehumanization. Now he's turned his experiences into a book of linked stories following 9 correctional officers over the course of 1 year on the job. Barker House is a fascinating and detailed look at an environment that few on the outside know or understand. We talk about that and also about Maloney's take on what needs to change in America's criminal justice system. David Maloney, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, this book takes place in a corrections house, a medium security prison, is that right?
So it's a county jail. So for those that don't know, typically jails are where people are housed while they are awaiting trial, or if they've been sentenced to 2 years or less, depending on the state. In New Hampshire, if it's 2 years or less, you can do your time at the county jail. And so there are pretrial individuals and sentenced. So once you are sentenced, typically you go to prison. So this is sort of, county jails are unique because they have people with very low-level crimes, but also high-level crimes as well.
And those high-level crimes are awaiting trial.
Yes. So there were higher security units depending on your bail or what you've been accused of. Those units were more restrictive and they had less freedoms during the day.
Right. And you worked in a jail like this, is that right? In New Hampshire? And that was a county jail.
Yes. I worked there for 4.5 years in my early 20s. It was in Hillsborough County. So it's the largest county in New Hampshire.
Oh, so it would take, I guess it would be, the county would have a wide variety of demographics. But what was your experience? I mean, New Hampshire's pretty white. What kind of demographics was the county jail you were in and the one that's here in the book?
So the county jail I was in was roughly 75% white. And then there was Hispanic officers and inmates, because Hillsborough County is southern New Hampshire, so it kind of shares a border with Massachusetts. I live in Massachusetts, and I lived in Massachusetts when I worked in New Hampshire. I traveled. I live about 2 miles from the border. So I worked in New Hampshire and lived in Mass. And so I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is very diverse. I think it's the second largest Cambodian population in the country, second to Los Angeles. And so it was strange for me to drive 15 miles north and it be one of the, you know, the whitest populations in the country. But we did have a mix. A lot of the people who were being held there, a lot were from New York State and Massachusetts. A lot of drug offenses and the drug trade would go through New Hampshire. So it was a lot of people that were just cutting through and were arrested. So it didn't really reflect the demographic of the county itself. I think the county is one of the whitest in the country.
But I would assume then in economic terms, most of the people in the county jail were working class or unemployed working class. Is that right?
Yes. And I started working there in 2007. So right before the financial crash in 2008. And so from 2008 till 2010, we were pretty full. And it was a lot of theft, home invasions, you know, smaller crimes, petty crimes, that a lot were just people trying to survive. And, you know, whenever the economy is bad, crime is up. So we were pretty full. At one point, we were over full. We had cots in the gym. So it got pretty full then. And just in contrast, you know, just last year, sort of before the pandemic and everything, the jail was at about 40% capacity, the one I used to work at. So when the economy is good, the jail seems to be empty. So, you know, they work together. But in terms of how that translates to my book, I did call it Barker County and not Hillsborough County. But if anyone knows Hillsborough, you know, I write about Nashua, Manchester, Hollis, and all these places, they are in Hillsborough County. So a lot of the people I wrote about reflect sort of the real life people in Hillsborough.
And before we get to them, I just want to ask you, why did you become a corrections officer? Was this something that you had foreseen you doing and were interested in doing, or something that you did because that was just the only real job around?
Yeah, I think it was the latter. I never wanted to work in law enforcement. I went to school to be a teacher, and I didn't do well my first round of college. So I actually failed out of school, when I was 19, and I spent the next 2 years sort of trying to find my footing with work. I worked a lot of odd jobs, and I started working at a mental hospital in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, and I worked in a secured unit for juveniles. And so it was kind of almost like, you know, a mini jail. There were, you know, all the doors were locked and barbed wire on top of the fence in the yard. And, you know, it was very restrictive. And so when I left there, the experience I gained there sort of just translated into working at the jail. And, you know, when I was looking for a job that I could have a better pension, more stability, that all the skills I had was working in security and working with people. So the jail just felt like a natural progression. But it wasn't something I ever anticipated doing. So I left the jail in 2011 because I had enough. I had a moment where I had to decide if I was going to stay there for the 20 years and get my pension or call it quits and change. And the things that I had seen there, the things that I was going through at the time, I just couldn't see myself even surviving 20 years.
Why is that?
So I worked on the restricted housing unit, and I think it was because of my mental health background. And at the time, New Hampshire jails, they were using them as mental hospitals. So a lot of the men on my unit didn't really belong in jail. They should have been getting psychiatric help, mental health counseling. And so to see the conditions they were living in and how I had to treat them in my capacity, I just couldn't do that anymore. It was too difficult to do every single day.
Yeah. So these stories, David Maloney, the stories that are in Barker House are linked stories of 9 characters in 4 sections. 4 sections: kingdom, property, numbers, and underhand. I get property. There's a property section of the jail. And I get numbers because, as we'll talk about in a minute, there's a connection between numbers and prisoners' names. But tell us about these 4 different sections. Why did you divide the stories into these 4?
So this came up sort of as an editorial decision. And myself and my editor, were trying to find a way for to structure this so that readers, you know, could follow along easily. You know, before we didn't have the narrators or the character's name at the beginning of the chapters. And it might take a page or two to figure out sort of whose head you were in or which character you were following. And so we wanted to find a way to structure it. But for Kingdom, that sort of comes up. That one was a difficult one, but it comes up in Mentor's story. And I sort of like the idea of, you know, all these people are living in their sort of own little kingdoms, and some believe that they're the masters of them. And there's a really difficult character, Jacobins, who's an inmate, and who's a alleged child molester. And so he says a really eerie line to Mentor that really bothers him. And so I think that's sort of where Kingdom came from, and I just like the idea of it. But Underhand is sort of by itself at the end. It's the, you know, part 4. And I think that, I know it's sort of, but just the underhand tactics, and there's a play on underhand in the softball game. So, but at first we didn't have them broken up this way. And it's funny. It's like, you know, you write a short story collection, the link stories like this, and then you have to decide how to order them. And it makes me think of, you know, when I used to make like mixtapes or burnt CDs, you know, you have to figure out the mood that each song is going to create one after another when listened to. And we sort of did that with this book. It went through a lot of different orders, but I think we settled on a good one.
And you mentioned Mensur. I wanted to talk about him as well, because, I mean, there are many issues that really are raised by these stories, and things that I've always kind of wondered about, you know, issues of power, issues of how power can corrupt, you know, of human people having to go against their human instincts. The Mensur story is one where, you know, he succumbs, one could say, very unprofessionally to his human disgust with this inmate and really crosses some boundaries. I wonder if, you know, if you could talk about that story within that context. I mean, how much does this happen, you know, that people really get their emotions in the way? And I'm asking this, you know, in the context of a time we're talking now when Black Lives Matter demonstrations are happening all over the country, and we are seeing what one could argue is very unprofessional behavior by the police. Incredible brutality and revenge and failure to observe just the basic norms of keeping people safe and preserving, you know, their right to peacefully demonstrate as guaranteed in the Constitution. So now I kind of made a comment, but you don't have to hew to that comment, but it was in, you know, it, that kind of idea of the rules on the one hand, which can be brutal or humanizing, versus the human being who's carrying them out, who can be more human or less human than the rules.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I tried to set up that sort of, because what's worse than in sort of the hierarchy of crimes, especially in our society, is, you know, a child molester. Even in the ecosystem of the jail, there isn't anything worse that you can do. There's a lot of crimes that inmates and officers will sort of, you know, agree with. And child molesting is one that there's a sort of collective angst against. So I sort of wanted to set it up that way, and then to show that what happens when an officer crosses the line for what he thinks is the right thing, right? Like Mensur thinks he's doing something heroic at the end of that story. And for a lot of readers, even while I was writing it, I felt this cringeworthy moment, you know, because he is crossing a line and he doesn't even see it. He's so caught up in what's been going on around him. And I think I know I've spoken a lot about this the last few days, just because I do understand how power can corrupt you. I've succumbed to it myself and still deal with sort of, you know, the moral guilt with all of that. But for this to be happening on a grand scale over the last sort of week, when even the officers know they're being videotaped, that's sort of where my understanding of succumbing to it is lost. I don't, because a lot of times in jails and prisons, the cameras are manipulated, videos are lost. You know, the cameras were down that day. It was a joke that everyone used to always say when someone did something wrong. It was very simple to just lose the tapes. And so for them to be doing it to reporters on live broadcasts, I just don't understand I do understand how they think they have a free pass to do this because of the rhetoric of the last 3 years and law and order, right? I think a lot of us are forgetting the law part, and now it's just order. So, and control, and to gain control. And so I think there's also a fear from the officer's point of view of being outnumbered. So we always had that fear as officers inside a jail. If we had, 35 officers working a shift and there were 900 inmates, you know, we were outnumbered by a large margin. But it was always sort of if you stuck together and showed no weakness, then we couldn't lose. And I think that we're seeing that mentality happen out in the streets.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with David Maloney about his book, Barker House. So you said, you know, there are things that you regret that you did, and if you feel comfortable sharing what you did, you know, I'd like to ask you about that. But even if you're not, you know, what were the circumstances under which you kind of lost your moral compass?
Well, I think when you felt like it, a lot of times we would write somebody up for doing something wrong. And we would see then the disciplinary action against them didn't sort of rectify the situation. So a lot of officers felt that they needed to go beyond and enact the punishment themselves. And a lot of times that happened when it felt like it was a personal attack on them. So for about 8 months while I was working there, we had a group of inmates who were awaiting trial band together and sort of protest how the jail was run. And so they decided to throw fecal matter and urine at us on an every shift basis, first shift, second shift, third shift, for almost 8 months daily. And at the time, there was no law saying that that was an assault on an officer if you put them in contact with your bodily fluid. So if we wrote them up, there was no punishment because in-house, they would just be left on the same unit they were already on. So they knew that they could continue doing it and nothing would happen to them. And so I think that just broke down a lot of us. I mean, I saw grown men I worked with, you know, sobbing in the bathroom because they were so angry and there was really nothing they could do. And, you know, we didn't know if we were bringing disease home to our families. We just didn't. There was a lot of anger and sort of the system wasn't allowing it to be corrected. So a lot of officers decided to, that was a time where they would enact their own punishment and in different forms.
You know, it's so interesting. As you were talking, I was thinking, you know, it's kind of a mirror image of what's being protested out in the streets now, because as you pointed out before, I mean, so many police departments really act, or police officers act with absolute impunity because they haven't been corrected. There's been no way to correct them for the use of excessive force that has, you know, often led to death. And so people have gotten so frustrated because there was nothing that worked. You know, they went out in the streets. Now, most of them have been peaceful, but you can it's kind of a mirror situation where people are driven to when they feel hopeless and there is no recourse.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's especially for someone like from an ex-law enforcement, for me to be, you know, on board with defunding the police. You know, it's just, if you asked me that while I was working at the jail, I would have told you you're crazy. We need more money for the jails and police officers. I think it takes removing yourself from that situation because, you know, like I said, jails are these ecosystems that have their own sort of rules. And unless you live through them, it's really difficult to explain the rationale. Because if I tried to right now, I would sound like a crazy person. But at the time, I would have been so convinced that what we were doing was correct and right. And so I do think a lot of what's happening, these officers, I'm not apologizing for them, but I bet they believe that they do have the right to respond the way they're responding, that they're within that power. They've actually been tasked with doing that. That's what their jobs are. And so the frustration of burning down an entire, you know, precinct it's sort of the only place that we've seen in Minneapolis with actions actually being taken by the city where protesters acted out in the same way that the police officers are acting towards them.
This book, Barker House, David Maloney, you know, really kind of explores that the relationship between domination and dehumanization, you know, and the dehumanization of prisoners, which certainly goes on, and also the sense that it dehumanizes the guards. And do they feel that, or do they feel kind of the culture buoys them up and gives them you know, the sense that they're right and they're doing the right thing?
I mean, I think there might be a mix of that. I think a lot of them do think they're doing the right thing. There are, I mean, it's also like a feeling out thing. So like there's the story in the book assigning numbers, and, you know, Officer Kelly is conflicted with sort of how the old guard treats inmates, how, and he's trying to find a new balance as he sort of takes over the power. And I think that's a lot of the struggle, because if you don't fall in line, you don't really have a career. So a lot of times you do look the other way, or you do do something that you don't agree with, because you know, you want to be promoted when promotions come up in a few years, and you want to be respected. And if you do get assaulted and you call for help, you want to make sure people do come and help you. So you almost feel like you have to do it to survive that environment. And I don't know if that's the officer's fault completely. I think the system is failing everybody inside those walls, and it's putting them in impossible situations almost every single day.
Could you say more about that, or give an example? And then, you know, I'll follow it up by asking, can it be reformed?
So I saw the Floyd video a lot, and I've spoken with some people I used to work with about it. And it would take a lot for one of those, especially the two officers who were only on the job for 4 days, to remove another officer during, I'll call it a restraint, but that wasn't really a restraint. And so newer officers are put in that position a lot, especially in jail. And, you know, we had, when I first started working, there's a tactic that some inmates will do to ruin your day, and is they flood their cell. So they jam their mattress underneath the sort of opening in the cell door. There's like a 4-inch opening between the door and the floor. And then they clog the toilet, and they just keep flooding it and flooding it till the cells, you know, are full of like a foot of water. And then they pull the mattress out of the door, and it floods the unit, you know. And that's a good way to ruin an officer's shift, because now they're the ones that has to clean that up and dry the floors and squeegee them. And so there was once when I first started working there, and we responded, and I was still an officer candidate, so I didn't even have a badge yet. I was still training. And to sort of teach the inmate a lesson, an officer held them down in the water face down. And so as someone that is just started working there, I didn't even know the officer's name yet. There wasn't a scenario where I could have pulled him off. You know, it's sort of, you just frozen in that moment. And I think that's the sort of impossible situation I'm talking about.
You know, today I heard that the Minneapolis City Council is planning on dismantling the police department and kind of starting over. They feel it's impossible to reform the department as it is. If you were starting from scratch in a county jail of the kind that you worked in, what are some of the things that you would do? And maybe this is unfair to ask you because you weren't prepared, but I'm sure you have lots of ideas of how things could have been better.
Yeah, I think bail reform is a big one. We had a lot of people in jail that had very low bail that should not have been there. I think we could empty the jails with bail reform. And I also think there should be more assistance with getting people out of the jail as quickly as possible. Some people, I mean, I guess it's because the courts are clogged up, but that's a whole nother thing. But, you know, if you shouldn't be awaiting trial for 2.5 years. Some days I'd come into work and I'd work a different unit than I had worked a year before, and I'd see someone and I'd say, how are you still here? You know, like I could not believe that they were still awaiting their trial. So I think a lot of it is a coordination with the court system itself and sort of moving people through quicker. I would also look at anyone that is still in prison for a marijuana charge. There's a billboard at the end of my street telling you how to buy weed online. And then I think about all the people still in prison for selling marijuana or buying it or, you know, being caught with it. So I think we need to empty the overcluttered jails and prisons we already have. I think that'd be a good start. But it's also sort of, you know, a lot of the hero worship. When I first started working there, you know, a captain would walk by or a lieutenant, and someone would nudge you and tell you war stories about them in the old days and the things they did. And so as a young man in my early 20s, very impressionable, you start to aspire to be them. You hear these stories and you want to be part of that culture. And so you would, like you said, start over. I think that'd be the best place to start from scratch, because a lot of the people that run these places, they're working off of an old system that's, you know, things they did 30 years ago, and they're still trying to get away with now.
And you point out both in the book and you've mentioned in this interview that a lot of people are there because they have mental health issues. What about diversion from jail to maybe more appropriate settings?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we only had one on-site psychiatrist for the inmates, you know, then there should be more. There should be a lot more. And I think also the officers should be getting treatment as well while they're there. A lot of times, a lot of that went unchecked. And there was also the culture that, you know, you didn't want to look weak and ask for help. So I think the whole culture needs to be changed, and it should be okay to ask for help after you've seen something traumatic, especially when it happens so frequently.
And I've really taken advantage of you to talk mostly about your own experiences, but I'd like readers to know that this is really a terrific collection of stories, Barker House. David Maloney, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, both about the book and your own experiences and your thoughts about how things need to change at this time in the criminal justice system.
Thank you. And I don't mind ceding time to the larger issues, because I know my book is important, but there's also something happening right now that's even more important. So I don't mind talking about that at all.
And your book is also a lens on those issues, even though it's not explicitly political. You know, you really put people right into the experience inside in a way that I think few of us really understand. And I think it really does add to our understanding of those larger issues. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
David Maloney teaches writing at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Barker House is his first book. Next week, join us for a terrific conversation with Elizabeth Wetmore about her novel, Valentine. It's a haunting exploration of the intersections of violence and race, class and gender in Western Texas during the 1970s oil boom. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.